not have a...
Okay, you want Dick Noble up there?
I want my lawyer.
The committee probably hasn't read tonight's paper, but it says that, who is it? It's Noble, Cooney, and who?
Represent the old man.
Who represent the old man? I thought it was the third one we got in there, too.
You just said it's a bill.
Well, since we're working on also insurance provisions, do we need Lester up there? Or whenever you want to say something, Lester, let me know. You can relax.
Rather not be included now.
He doesn't want his name in the paper.
Okay, where do we start with the insurance provisions? That's where we want to know, is where we are.
Well, I have before me a long group and a short group.
Okay.
I'm starting with the short group. The short group is 1, 2, 3, the fourth page.
All right, we've marked out everything that's not relevant on here. You don't want us to go to section 13, you don't want to start there? That's the statement of intent.
That's the preamble.
Let's go through it. Let's see. Joe, would you, you have anything you want to, now, section 13 is the restatement of the whereases, right?
Yes, Madam Chair. I simply rewrote it as one paragraph, made a new section. Statement of policy and a finding of the legislature.
What's that, page 3 of the...
What page is 13 on?
Page 3 of the back section.
The back.
Section 13 is a statement of intent. Legislative purpose. Legislative intent, whatever you want to call it. Okay, section 14 now, Tom, or whoever, which one's going to carry the burden?
You want us to read it?
I want you to explain it, and we'll get the language here, section by section.
Section
1.
Section 14, sub 1,
mm-hmm.
states that an Oregon physician who obtains professional liability coverage in the amount of $500,000 for each occurrence, and who pays the prescribed fee, which is later set at $500, shall not be liable to any person beyond the limits of such professional liability insurance for occurrences of that year. It, in effect, says that if a physician buys professional liability insurance with a limit of $500,000 per occurrence and pays fee to it $500. He and the insurance company had a limited liability of that amount.
Okay, sub 2.
Sub 2 is the same language but deals with insurance policies that are written on a claims made basis. And it says, and this takes into consideration the doctors covered by St. Paul. And it says in sub 2 that a physician who carries $500,000 professional liability coverage on a claims made basis and is paid as $500 per year, he has the same immunity and his insurance company has the same immunity beyond $500,000.
Okay, he's covering by his own private insurer, but he pays the $500 in.
Just exactly the same.
So, okay.
And the only reason for setting them separately is in paragraph 1 we designate particularly the type of policy as an occurrence policy. And if we left that, those doctors that elect to insure under St. Paul wouldn't be able to fall within the protection of this bill. And so it says that if they have a claims made policy in the amount of $500,000, per claim and pay their $500, then they get the same immunity.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, Subsection 3 deals with the peculiar problem that exists in claims made policies, which in effect is that after the physician retires on a claims made policy, he must continue to carry insurance for a designated number of years to protect claims made after his retirement. And so this provision says that if the physician retires and maintains his claim made policy by paying the continued premiums for the continuation of that policy after his retirement, and pays his $500 into the fund for the same number of years he's required to pay it under his insurance policy, his protection will continue. Now, the St. Paul policy has a provision that after the physician retires, if he pays premiums for two more years, then they pick him up for everything that ever was made. Designed to allow them to have the same benefit as the insurance policy.
Okay, and his private insurer sets the, how long he's going to have to pay that?
I'm sorry?
His private insurer says how long he has to pay it, so you would require him to pay into the fund for the same period of time?
As long as he has to pay the premium for the insurance.
Okay. What are you calling this 500, this fund?
What's the name of it?
Annual fee.
Medical Access Liability Fund.
The what?
Medical Access Liability.
Do we come to that in a minute?
Yes.
Well, why, should there be a reference to that here, Joe?
Well, we say he pays the annual fees required by Section 18, this is 18.
All right, okay.
Section 4. States that if the individual gets a settlement or a judgment in excess of the $500,000 limit, he should look to the excess fund.
Shall receive, okay. Go ahead.
Section.
Anybody has questions, speak up as we go along.
Madam Chairman.
Okay, Senator Smith.
What happens to the GP whose insurance maximum goes up dramatically? Is it provision that he may take out lower limits?
No physician is required to come up with this plan. It's optional, but if he wants to obtain the immunity from liability over $500,000, he must participate.
I got you.
But he's free not to participate, he can carry $100,000 limits.
Or zero.
Or zero, it's not a required insurance plan.
Okay, Section 15.
Section 15.
Got a typing here. Is that typing now, claimant?
Yeah.
Section 15 deals with the problem of contribution and indemnity. It says that when the insurance carrier for the physician has paid its full $500,000 to the claimant, no other person shall have a claim for indemnity or contribution back against the physician or his insurance company. That frequently arises in cases where you might have a doctor in a hospital joined in a case.
Yeah.
And you might have a judgment for $1 million. And the hospital might pretend that it is only vicariously liable, and therefore under the common law entitled to indemnity back fully against the physician. And this is designed to say that if the insurance company has paid the full limit of the money for the protection of the injured patient and exhausted that limit, then the other person who might have the right for contribution or indemnity loses that right. The idea is to protect that the money under the insurance policy goes to the injured claimant first. If the fund is not exhausted,
Now, who are you thinking might be another person who would...
A hospital or another doctor or a drug company. That's where we get into potential claims for indemnity or contribution.
Okay.
It cuts off the right of indemnity or contribution if the policy limits have been paid to the injured patient. Section 2... says, in any event, no person except the injured patient shall have a right to any of the proceeds of the excess liability fund, and no person claiming indemnity or contribution shall have any right to that at all. So it sets aside the commissioner's fund solely to compensate the patient. Whereas the preceding limits the right of contribution or indemnity only if the liability policy limits have been exhausted. But the overall thrust of the thing being that the primary
okay, in other words, you're saying if there's someone who can bring in an action because of this, what about loss of consortium, Dick, that sort of thing? You're saying that that doesn't...
Wouldn't bar that. Because the person that's bringing the loss of consortium action would be a claim. And so that would not be barred. This is to protect the fund from the same claim of contribution or indemnity. For example, if you sued a doctor and a drug company, for example, both were held liable for, say, $2 million total damages, the doctor's fund or doctor's insurance company would pay $500,000, and then the plaintiff would collect something from the excess liability fund. Well, the drug company may come in and say, well, we should never have been held liable for more than half of it, and we want some of the money back, and that's protecting the fund being taken by the drug company or anyone else seeking contribution or indemnity.
Okay.
I don't know how to explain it very adequately.
Yeah, it's, for me it's Section 16.
Section 16 sets forth for mechanics where a claimant recovers a judgment in excess of $500,000 against a physician. It allows a procedure where the court may then determine whether or not the physician is a complying physician, having the $500,000 and made his contribution. Upon satisfying itself of that, the court shall order insurance commissioners shall pay to the claimant the excess amount from the fund pursuant to some regulations or procedures set forth later on. It's designed to get a judgment in excess of the $500,000. The court then makes a finding as to whether the physician is a complying physician, but he has the required $500,000, made his $500 contribution. Then court issues a directive to the commissioner saying that this is a valid claim to be assessed against the excess fund.
Okay. Section 2 speaks to settlement.
Section 2 deals with settlements. It says when an individual has agreed to it, and a physician have agreed to a settlement in excess of $500,000, shall petition any circuit court in the state of Oregon for an order approving the settlement and requiring payment of the amount in excess of the $500,000 from the fund requires written notice, 10 days written notice to the commissioner to appear because he's the, has an interest in what's in the fund. After the hearing, if the court approves the settlement, she'll issue an order, again directing the commissioner to pay the amount of the excess over the $500,000 from the fund.
Why, if the court approves, if it's a settlement that's made out of court?
It was designed primarily to give some forum wherein the commissioner could be called in and say, no, that claim isn't worth in excess of the fund, of the $500,000, and the fund will not contribute to it.
What's your reaction, Dave?
I think it's okay for this reason. The lawyer representing the insurance carrier, once he's paid his $500,000, really doesn't have too much interest in how much more the claimant gets. In order to get the case settled, he might say, okay, we'll settle it for $1 million, because the second $500,000 doesn't come out of their pocket. And so this gives the commissioner some input as to whether or not the settlement in excess of $500,000 is or isn't reasonable. So that it takes the potential for, say, Mr. Cooney and I agreeing on an unreasonably high settlement above the $500,000 because his client, his insurance company client, isn't having to pay it. But we're just taking it out of the excess fund. In other words, he and I, who have no interest in this fund directly, are agreeing as to how much money that fund should pay. And so we say for that reason it should be set up on a basis where we have a potential settlement, that we petition the court for approval of the settlement, and that we notify the insurance commissioner so that he can come in and take a look at the circumstances. And then the court will have to make the final approval as to whether that is or is not a reasonable settlement, and thereby protect the
case.
Excessively high settlement.
Senator Smith, well, I wanted to know how the insurance commissioner is going to involve himself in the court procedure.
Yes. He would be notified of the petition for settlement and would have an opportunity then to appear and take whatever position he deems as appropriate.
He or somebody from the AG's office?
That
you have to be somebody from the AG's office. We have to have an attorney representing the department. Since the AG represents all administrative bodies, it has to be a lawyer.
Well, then the next question, should something be written in here that specifically says what we're saying, that there is input from the insurance commissioner through the Attorney General's office? It just says after hearing it. Does it say who can participate in that hearing? You give notice, but it doesn't really say that the state can actually get involved in the hearing.
Well, shouldn't you, Betty, put in something saying that the responsibility of the insurance commissioner to represent the fund in this capacity?
In the hearing.
In representing the fund, who actually is in charge of the fund? Is there a trustee set up, or is the insurance commissioner a trustee?
Insurance
commissioner. Right, so it should be clear that he is actually the insurance commissioner, or this fund is entitled to be represented at every stage in any litigation where the prayer exceeds $500,000, I would think. They certainly, if they're going to be nailed for it, they ought to be entitled to representation and participation in the trial and settlement.
Senator Smith, but we don't want the AG involved in every case.
Well, if the AG is just a lawyer, we don't want to trust him. Okay. He's going to have a lawyer if it gets to litigation.
I just want to run it through in my mind and then have you run it through yours, because as it stands, it really doesn't fit too well. It looks like that everybody knows what the prayer is, but no one knows what the judgment's going to be until the court makes a decision. And if it's over $500,000, this says that insurance commissioners call in, they say, well, what do you think, Les? He said, well, it's too high.
No, not on judgment, only on settlement.
Only on the settlement?
Only on
okay.
settlement. Because the judgment keeps that settlement.
Okay.
And it's only on the settlement. And as a practical matter, I don't know how you write this in the bill, but the way we do it, if I'm the lawyer representing whatever insurance company is carrying the primary, and I see a case that I think is going to be beyond the capability of my company's fund to settle it, I write to the reinsurer, who is the less, in effect, and say, this is a claim that has substantial potential, and usually advise them of it as we go along. Now, the statute doesn't require that I do that.
Yeah, well, that's the other problem that I, you know, that I'm trying to get to. In other words, he's called in from nowhere after you have discussed possible settlement. Nothing about the case. Is it possible that he or the Attorney General who represents him in this case, is it possible to give him the facts and then...
Oh yes, this is the reason for the notice, because then he would have come to Dick and I and say, what have you got on this thing?
Senator Cook, have something that you suggested prior to our amendment to that day about the insurance commissioner being involved in the settlement negotiations?
Yeah, I think that it should be in there that the if there is any settlement, and certainly any settlement in excess of $500,000, I would think the insurance commissioner ought to be involved.
Well, that's the purpose of the notice to him, that application will be made in, he said 10 days, it could be whatever time. Then he has noticed that this is coming up. He has access to our file and plaintiff's file, I'm assuming, and can evaluate whether or not he wishes to withhold consent or...
Suppose he doesn't agree.
Then I think it would be doubtful that the court would give approval to it and issue a directive requiring him to pay and say, all right, we're not going to say, let you try it, let the jury decide whether or not it's going to be worth more than $500,000. If you get stuck for more than $500,000, you're going to settle it for $25,000 more, you've got to pay $200,000 more. But I know that's the reason for dealing with the court at discretion, and have a spokesman for the fund there to raise objection and not put it simply in the hands of the lawyer.
Joe, how do you write it in so that we get the insurance commissioner in the court or his representative from...
I would imagine we would have to notify the insurance commissioner, then the plaintiff and the defendant's attorney would have to notify the insurance commissioner that in their opinion the settlement in a particular case may exceed $500,000. You would have to be brought in early if this participation is to be...
Okay, so they notify, and then they all three, but then they've got to go into court, and the question is, how is the insurance commissioner represented in court so that he is, in fact, a party to this hearing? Just giving him notice doesn't make him a party to the hearing.
So we're talking about settlement or a case?
Settlement. That's over $500,000. That'd be the only kind of situation that would occur. Settlement over $500,000. Well, okay, we've got to give him some legal status.
Well, if you give him a notice, then you could state that a representative of the commissioner's office, designated by him, designated the AG, shall appear at the hearing.
Well, but he ought to be able to request a hearing on his own motion, as trustee.
Well, not if the, well, the injured claimant is the one that's trying to get into the fund, and he can't get into the fund unless he gets the court approval and gives notice to the commissioner. And that brings him in.
But the court can issue an order without having a hearing.
No. Now, the only thing that you might do after notice 10-day notice in appearance or written approval by the commissioner that would exclude his required attendance.
I would think as a practical matter, Chairman, I would think as a practical matter that if you got at that point where you thought that the settlement ought to be $750,000, that the fund trustee would want to review with the attorneys the entire file and make a determination.
That's the reason for the notice, so that he could do that.
Then, well, don't you, the notice is kind of a little bit late, I would think, isn't it?
Well, we debated about that. I don't care how long the notice is. The problem is you delay the injured patient if you get an agreement that you want to give him.
I suppose the court could postpone the decision.
Well, that's the other thing. If he appears and says, this is a very complicated case and I can't within the 10 days' time come to a decision, I'm sure the court would give him the time to evaluate it. We vacillated between making it long so they could really look at it as opposed to what effect that might have on a desperate claimant who needs money. This was we originally had 5 days, and we thought that wasn't going to get enough time, so we moved it back to 10 days.
Do you need to have, would it be necessary, or would you have authority to settle on a covenant not to sue in a case like this? Could there be a settlement with the primary carrier reserving the rights to the claimant against the excess carrier?
There'd be no real reason for that.
You might have a situation where the primary carrier recognizes the damages are more than $500,000. The game is up. It's just, there's no doubt that that's owed. Are you going to hold up the payment of anything until you determine whether it's beyond that?
Let me suggest a procedure here, that when the individual petitions the circuit court for an order, that a copy of that petition be served on the insurance commissioner, which is the notice. And that when the insurance commissioner receives a copy of the petition, that he then be given authority to meet with the two attorneys on his own initiative to request attorneys to evaluate the case, and if he approves, then there is no further proceeding in the court. That saves the court a heck of a lot of time.
He can file a written approval.
He could file a written approval. If the insurance commissioner does not approve after the review, then he is made a party to the court proceedings and is to appear at the time stated and state why he has refused to approve. And then the court will hear all of the parties, will hear the insurance commissioner, who I assume will be represented by an AG's deputy, and then will, and the lawyers, and then the court, after the hearing, the court will issue its decision.
That would be satisfactory from our standpoint.
It's no problem.
I'd like to add one caveat, however, Madam Chairman, to make certain that the fund does not become a party defendant if, in case the court decides that it's not acceptable and proceed on in the court. But as making the insurance commission with the fund a party only for the purpose of that hearing.
Right. And only for the determination of the settlement. Okay, do you see any problems with that, then, Betty? But it's... We'll have to work out the language, too. Mm.
The trustee, I don't see how I could ever make the decision without going to court.
Could he approve it?
I don't think any trustee would want to.
I agree with you, Sandra. If I'm the one thinking that there'll be court determination here in the case. But I don't see that's going to be that big a problem.
It's only in those cases where we settle over $500,000.
Well, I understand that, but then what's the point of having the commissioner review it, and then if he approves, he doesn't appear in court, we wouldn't have to put that provision in.
Well, except if somebody that's not my successor may, they're not here to get
it. It won't be that long.
Well, if the insurance commissioner says in his opinion that the proposed settlement is reasonable and he filed such a certificate with the court, then I assume that the court would just go ahead and approve the settlement since all parties involved have then agreed, and that's the end of the matter, no contest, no further hearing.
So what we're saying is even though they might come and it might be a perfectly valid settlement, that I would think any person of the trustee of this fund would be accepting a great deal of more responsibility than necessary without having the court approve something there. I personally.
Even if you had the AG advising you on whether or not it was a.
Especially.
This provision.
That if he agrees?
Yeah, it's still important to have in there because it gets back to the original question.
Are you
clear?
Petition served on the commissioner.
Yes.
If he agrees, then he notifies the parties in the court. And does not have to make the court appearance. If he does not, then he is a party, but only in the sense of for the purposes of the settlement. Okay. I'll let you worry about where to put that, Joe, in the language there. Okay, next page 7, sub 3. Prefer the word claimant there, everybody? Insurance company to a claimant who has a final judgment. Okay, section 17.
This says that when the insurance commissioner receives a court order requiring payment of the monies from the excess fund, be it by excess judgment or settlement, he shall pay the amount stated in the court order. The insurance commissioner may, at his option, under rules promulgated by him, pay monies from the medical excess liability fund as follows: in a lump sum, in installments, or as annuities, or as an annuity over a period of years, as the insurance commissioner by rules determines. C. By pro rata payments to entitled claimants in relationship to the available funds. Gives him the option.
What was received in installments, and would he get interest on it?
I Well, he's entitled to, out of the law now, he's entitled to his interest on his judgment, but his judgment's been satisfied. So that would cut off the interest, and whether he gets interest or doesn't get interest would be depending on what we add or don't add here.
But if he doesn't have a judgment and he has a settlement, and the court has issued an order, the order isn't the same as the judgment, so how would you get his interest then?
Well, I'm saying that even with the judgment, the way it stands now, it doesn't indicate whether he gets interest or doesn't get interest on a delayed payment plan.
Wouldn't you assume that he would, though, if it were delayed? That would be one of the factors in determining the annuity, I would think.
Well, one of the, I don't care, but my thought is this. Do you want to deplete the fund by paying to a claimant interest on his delayed claim, which from that interest might have gone to another claimant as part of his collection of the full amount?
Well, when you buy an annuity, isn't there a calculation of the interest? I don't know much about annuities, but you buy an annuity, certainly the interest factor must be considered when the annuity is purchased.
When you buy an annuity, you perhaps buy a $100 a month annuity for 20 years, and let's assume that that comes out to a cash value of $20,000. You buy the annuity for $17,000.
Yeah, but wouldn't you have the same thing here? Let's say you've got a $750,000 judgment. The annuity, I think of the annuity, here you got a $250,000 current claim. Now, I would think that when, if you took that $250,000 and you bought an annuity for your life expectancy, when those people that figure these things, they're going to consider the interest factor in their overall calculation. And so I think you take that $250,000 and figuring out what the annual payment would be over the life expectancy of this person, you do it just like you were walking into Standard Insurance and marking out $250,000.
Well, you understand, this is over $500,000.
I know.
And they don't know whether it's going to be pro-rata. It could be pro-rata. If the fund is depleted, it's going to be pro-rata. There's no, the question here, there's no way you would determine.
But on the other hand, it might not be depleted.
Yeah, we're not assuming it's depleted, and I don't think we should be assuming that. As a matter of fact, the annuity idea, and I don't know if it's carried through in the next section, but as we discussed it, the annuity idea was to permit spreading the payment over time so as to avoid the depletion, present depletion of the fund, so that you'd have any prorate.
Madam Chairman. Senator Cook, are you differentiating that, saying that in the annuity, this says by installments or annuity. So if we bought an annuity, that would be the end of it. You'd get his annuity, but there no interest would be paid on the annuity.
So well, that's how you park out it. I don't know, how do they figure out annuity?
Well, it's, you take the life expectancy and you figure out the total, get a, the cut off or the reduction of the total amount you pay, and the I imagine almost certain that they put in a factor for the interest on the money that they receive on. But on the installments, I'm trying to visualize when you'd ever pay a person off on an installment rather than buy an annuity, and I don't.
It'd be the same thing, wouldn't it? It's just a question of whether the funds. Really, isn't that just a different way, probably, of stating the same thing? You either buy an annuity or the fund uses the same basis to determine the installments. So either way,
you might just pay off installments if they're just a short period of time. You're going to pay off something in a year's time, and you only had $100,000 to pay them $10,000 a month or something like that. But
I think in any event,
if we want, the philosophy, as I understand it, behind this bill is that we're going to give this person, or hoping to give this person, the same rights that he'd have if there weren't any bill and there were unlimited insurance available. We don't want to deprive anyone of anything. We're just trying to figure out a way to accomplish it. So if that's the philosophy, he said, we say that's $250,000 more, we're going to decide how he's going to get it, though. He can't demand cash. If in the interest of maintaining the solvency of the fund, if the commissioner feels it's better in terms of the fund to pay him off on an annuity, as an annuity, then he should do it. But still, you got the $250,000 under my assumption. Present value, I think you should look at it as though he walked into Standard Insurance and gave him $250,000.
Well, why can't we just say an installment with interest or an annuity?
Yeah, well, whatever language that would accomplish this.
Does the word annuity in your interpretation include an interest factor, in your opinion?
Well, I'm sure that the actuaries have never thought about it, but I'm sure they must take it into consideration, because when they take that money and then project it out over the life expectancy of the annuity, they've got to determine how much that money would have earned if the person had the money in his hand, invested it, and so forth.
Is annuity defined anywhere? If we define annuity,
somebody ought to be able to define
it. Get a definition back, the officer. Well, get a claim now who's a life actuary, or Ron Emery, who's the standard. I'm just positive that that's a factor they take into account, because that's the purpose of an annuity, is to take all these things in and spread it out over a period of time.
Then what's our problem?
I don't see any real problem.
Oh, well, then the question is, if you're talking about installments, I assume that would mean less than the question of annuity. He already has the opportunity for lump sum.
I guess there's another option. I think there are two ways. The annuity is a special breed of cat. An installment, as indicated here, you're just going to pay it over 5 years, maybe. Now there, it should clearly bear interest, I would think. The same interest that the judgment would bear. If it's 6%, which I think it is now, those installments should bear 6% interest on the unpaid balance. I mean, that would seem reasonable.
Yeah. From my standpoint, it doesn't make any difference whether you pay interest or you don't pay interest. The only thing is, what you might be doing
is depleting.
Paying to this man here his full judgment plus interest.
But that's included in the pro rate.
But
our philosophy is that we're going to make him whole. Go ahead.
You might be paying to the early bird into the fund his full judgment plus interest, and then later down the line you might end up, because you paid this man interest, not have enough to pay him his full dollar for dollar. And that's my only concern. Do you want to be paying interest at the risk of depleting the fund, so that you may not be getting people their full judgment? I don't care.
Madam Chair,
Senator,
I thought when this suggestion first came up, that was the whole purpose of it right there. It was going to be a tax settlement, and then it was going to be an installment if it looked like the fund wasn't going to be able to afford it in a specified period of time. And I think the interest does raise the overall danger of somebody not getting their share.
Well, when you figure the payment and you're going to make it on installments, and you figure interest into it, which is ultimately going to increase the whole payment, it's going to be made over a period of years. If the commissioner finds it's nevertheless necessary to prorate or reduce the claim, it can be reduced. But if there's money there, but the claimant has to wait for 2 or 5 or 10 years to get it all, I should see no reason why shouldn't get interest, so long as there's money in the fund available to pay it. And if there isn't money in the fund available to pay it, the fact that it says bears interest at 6% doesn't stop the commissioner from reducing the overall payout to prorate it because of insufficient funds. So I think it should be in there with the interest.
I am too, because it's his option.
I would move that there be interest on the reasonable interest on the install.
Okay, we'd add in installments with reasonable interest or as an annuity over a period of years.
Which would include interest as a factor, we assume. However, they
Madam Chairman,
it does.
It does.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Powell.
I would like to know who's going, does the claimant have the option? Now, this all depends on the rules. They will if you say they can't, by your rules. And that's one of the things that concerns me about this section, is that if we change commissioners, he can come in and set a whole new set of rules. Maybe he has a bias against people getting installments with interest or something. And just rule that out, because that whole section there, A, B, and C, are at the discretion. It says insurance commissioner may, at his option, under rules promulgated by him, pay money from the fund as follows. He doesn't have to. And whose option is it going to be? Because I see some inconsistency in a person being able to, on the same dollar amount claim against this fund, one person is going to, I don't know, it doesn't seem to me that we should jeopardize the fund.
Well, you see, one of the problems you're going to have to, the reason you've got to give a discretion to the commissioner, is in the early stages, while that fund is building, it would be very undesirable to pay a lump sum and immediately exhaust the fund. And he may, for the first few years, opt in order to preserve and build the funds so that people will have enough funds to collect, elect to pay out in installments so that you don't exhaust it. And if you make it mandatory that on day one he pay a lump sum, you're going to bankrupt the fund in the beginning.
What happens when the party, when the claimant's deceased, to the remainder, if they're, say they're getting paid on installments?
That's covered in there where we say that in the event of his death, his personal representative can pursue.
Okay, what happens to a person who pays in installments on a substantial claim against the fund of just maybe a little bit more than the interest? Is that feasible, that the person might want just $10,000 a year for the rest of his life, if that's what he chooses, and maybe that's, what is 6% interest on $200,000?
$1,000.
Okay, so he just wants that. And so the person has quite a life expectancy and just takes that amount of money.
I think that's something that you, the commissioner, can buy an annuity and buy an annuity for.
Well, some judges around the boy that went blind in Illinois, and I think he got a $600,000 judgment. The court ordered, he was 8 years old, the court ordered that be paid in annuity for the rest of his life. So he'd always be maintained. I don't think the insurance commissioner would have any trouble if they decided that, and in consultation with the people, they chose to take it by annuity. Of setting up an annuity program, that isn't any... You can buy an annuity with any major big life insurance company.
Question on the motion.
Okay, the motion is to insert with reasonable interest after the word installments in B. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Grimstead?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Hold on just a minute. There's two or three things bugging me, Vern, in language here. in subsection 2, could we say the insurance commissioner shall, under rules promulgated by him, and leave out at his option and change the word may to shall? Why do you say at his option? The insurance commissioner shall.
We were trying to give him the option as to which of these three ways.
Well, and then, after then A, you say in a lump sum, or B, in installments, so on, or C, by pro rata.
Well, that's the problem is if there was no fund, the fund were exhausting, or near exhaustion, you may declare a temporary moratorium.
Madam Chairman, on that same point, I was just thinking of the same thing you were in a different way. In rewording and maybe even restating the concept a little bit, if I were, here'd be my suggestion that you have down there after follows, in a lump sum, comma, in installments, or as an annuity, over a period of years, as the insurance commissioner by rule determines is necessary in order to maintain the solvency of the fund. And then C, by pro rata payments to entitled claimants in relation to the available fund, should the fund become insolvent. So, I wouldn't think that you'd want to start prorating unless you basically ran out of money or ran out of solvency. On the other hand, you want to encourage the administration of the fund so that eventually, over time, everyone is going to be paid. I think that's the basic idea.
Well, then what would you do with the language in sub 2 under at his option?
Well, I'd say I'd adopt yours. The insurance commissioner shall, under rule promulgated by him, pay money from the medical excess liability fund as follows. Then I'd have A and B as the basic modus operandi and C in case it went belly up.
How is that wording that you made on the last one?
All right, I have it under A in a lump sum comma, in installments, or as an annuity over a period of years as the insurance commissioner by rule determines is necessary in order to maintain the solvency of the fund. C, or B, whatever it is, by pro rata payments to entitled claimants in relationship to the available funds, should the fund become insolvent.
What happens if it's insolvent? There's no
payment.
Should
the fund become
depleted? Depleted, all right. Or depleted.
Use your language, Betty. If you use your language, the fund's insolvent. You can't compel him to pay money he doesn't have.
No. Well, all right. What's the general feeling here of this Burns motion to add to both B and C?
That's great. Hang on, I'm sure.
Well, except it really spells out what the intent is, I think.
Yeah. I don't know that.
All right. The motion is there any objection to the motion?
With the interest on the installment.
Oh, yeah, we've already got
it. Joe, did you get
what
that?
What do you have on C there?
Yes, I have it, ma'am.
All right.
But, you know, what do you put on C? I've got
A. And we're going to delete at his option.
Oh, you better
leave
it. Better leave it? Not
what that is. You guys check it out and see if we have to leave that at his option. We'll pick up at section 18 when we get back.
What's happening now?
Call the Senate.
When you had it, this is just language taking care of all of it.
Yeah, I
wish you all leave
it. Because the rest of that language takes care of it.
Okay, so will it be may or shall, and are we going to delete it as option?
Shall we adopt it?
Well, I ask you to decide what it should be. We adopted the with reasonable interest.
Well, it's going to be shall pay, shall under rule promulgated pay it, and then we set out the conditions down below.
So, yeah.
Why are we listening to the people?
Did you decide anything?
Well, I think that the additional language to propose, Senator Cook, would solve our problem. Insurance commissioner shall, under rules promulgated by him, pay monies as follows. Only three things that exist, three methods, give him the option in the event the fund is depleted or in danger of being exhausted to prorate among the claimants.
Okay, then the motion is to delete may at his option and insert the word shall. Is there any objection to that amendment? And we did adopt, I think, we adopted your amendments.
I think that last, yeah. Okay.
Joe, is there any reason, can we do without the ors between any of those so that there is, it's clear that just with a comma that there's
The usual form would be a semicolon after each and then
a semicolon.
An or after the next to the last grouping. So it would be an lump sum semicolon. And paragraph B would be in installments, so...
And you say you do or do not need the word or?
I'd use it once.
Once. And but not after...
After paragraph B.
Okay, you'd use it after paragraph what? B?
B.
Oh, okay. I'll let you worry about that then. All right, section 18.
Madam Chairman, before I forget, the Senate convenes at 9 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
Are you meeting in the morning, Beth?
And judiciary meets at 8. All right. Let's see how rapidly we can get through this. But let's stay alert. Okay, section 18.
Section 18 states that the physician who wishes to limit his liability under this act shall make his payment of the $500 on a date not later than specified by the insurance commissioner.
Madam Chairman, there's a point that worries me, and that is this. You put a fixed figure like this, and without any expiration time for the act, and I think it's entirely possible that you're simply building in the ultimate insolvency of this fund. Because we know that we have inflation, and we know that the value of everything goes up, including the value of one's body and life. And I think our original discussion was we're trying to develop an actuarially sound fund here. That while we're not guaranteeing it, and we can't guarantee solvency, but we're really aiming towards the objective that this fund is going to be adequate by these devices to cover any excess judgment. Now, I don't think that can be done by freezing the $500 figure in. And I don't think it's good enough to say, well, the next session can change it. Because we have the history in the workman's comp field of when you get a vested interest, they don't want to change anything. And it would seem that one ought to do one of two things. Either devise some standards and delegate the authority to somebody. I don't know if it should be the insurance commissioner, but it should be to someone to be able to modify the excess payment on sound insurance principles so that it will be sufficient to respond in payment of anticipatable excess judgments. Or alternatively, to provide a termination date for this act so that we all come into the game even. And so you come in, the physicians on the one hand, and maybe it shouldn't be this way to look at it, but it often is that way. The physicians on the one hand and the rest of us on the other,
the lawyers, that is.
The lawyers on the other and the citizens on the other, so that we have an even push, and so that you don't have to just be a good obstructionist. Because
okay, Senator Cook, we get your point.
Yeah, that's the point.
Senator Richard.
Okay.
I've been laboring under the impression that among the goals that we're striving for was to be able to make sure that physicians had insurance and that they had it at a reasonable rate. Also, testimony that we've heard is that there have been only two suits that reached a dollar figure of around the $500,000. Inflation or no inflation, there's also been
statements made that there's a high likelihood that there's going to be a great deal more interest in the medical profession to be much more prudent in their peer review and to get an opportunity to reach all of those things. I think that you've got to establish something that they can base as some figure that they can at least know where they're going to be for 2 years. And you can't achieve that if you're going to have a variable in there, in my view. I think that you've got to get to some kind of a reasonable. If they figure $500 is reasonable to achieve the $1 million to start out with a previous history that there hasn't been excessive things, and it would appear to me that that $500 figure should stay, not to toy with that and let it be a variable.
Madam Chairman, can I just kind of respond to this point?
Well, I want to respond to it, and that is, we don't expect this law to last into perpetuity. After all, the legislature will be meeting again in 75, and there are provisions for reporting to the legislature. We will have an interim committee study. There will be an opportunity to change this legislation, and I don't think that we need to deal with what may be this situation 10 or 15 or 30 years from now.
But, Madam Chairman, this law doesn't have a terminal date. Now, if we would put a terminal date on the law, and I'm not quarreling about the first 2 years, Chief, not at all, but I'm concerned about what happens if the 1977 session meets and the legislature or the governor is unable to do anything. Then you've got, perhaps, this $500 figure in a time when it simply will not support.
Do you have a motion to make, Senator Coon?
I'll move that we provide that this law shall go out of being on January 1, 1978. All right, now, speak to my motion. The point would be that this would give to the 1977 legislature an opportunity to evaluate the experience gained through the use of this fund between now and then. And the 1977 legislature would then be able to review the experience up to then, review the inflation, see how things are then. And if $500 is okay, fine, maybe $300 will be enough, or maybe it'll be $700, or maybe we'll have a better theory.
I'm sorry,
I'll amend the motion to reduce the statute of limitations to 3 years as well, and then I can support the motion.
The what?
Statute of limitations.
Well,
anyone else care to speak on the motion?
What's the motion?
Well, the motion is that this bill go out and all three new by the legislature go out of existence January 1, 1978, which would carry it through the next session of the legislature. The next session of the legislature would have an opportunity to review what had happened between now and then, and accept the 500, raise the lower, or whatever.
I'd ask for comments from the panel members, but I don't think it's necessary. Clerk will call a roll on the motion.
Senator Brown?
No.
Senator Burbidge?
No.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
No.
Senator Powell?
No.
Senator Smith?
No.
Senator Dernstedt?
No.
Madam Chairman?
No. Motion fails.
I'd like to make a motion conceptually that there be some kind of actuarial study done to allow the trustee to promulgate rules based on the study to make the charge to the doctors sufficient to sustain the fund.
You've made that motion?
I'm with that.
No. Chairman?
That's only a study.
Okay, sir.
I'd like to support that. That's a better motion than the one that I made, by far. And it really accomplishes what we ought to be accomplishing. Namely, you cannot predict the future. We were trying to set up an actuarially sound fund.
So I guess I'll make my same speech again, and that is, I think, Senator Brown, that there will be no doubt that there will be a study done during this interim to determine what is going to be the actuarial significance of this, and that it, again, in my opinion, isn't necessary for getting out this bill.
Well,
I'm sure it's going to be
done. Is there a paragraph in here? There was at one time about an interim study. Is it still in?
We deleted all of that because it also required the studying of accountants and lawyers and I don't know who all, dealing with malpractice, and have a guarantee from the president that there will be, this will be a part of an interim committee study or a special task force.
I bet your life the insurance commissioner is going to watch this. He's watching the dental fund like a hawk.
Question on the motion.
Well,
okay, question on the motion. Clerk will call the roll. Senator Burbidge.
I think that the commissioner did want to comment, and I think maybe we should hear from him.
Well, I would only amplify, Madam Chairman, that I would immediately start an actuarial study just as soon as this bill passes. Start right off with that. Have that available. That's going to be going properly.
Okay, the clerk will call the roll on the motion.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burbidge?
No.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
No.
Senator Powell?
No.
Senator Smith?
No.
Senator Thurston?
No.
Madam Chairman?
No. Motion passed. Now, quite a few people talked about setting this fund at $500 for all doctors. Are you going to break them up into classifications, or are they going to be happy, everybody being assessed $500?
I don't think you're going to find everybody satisfied in anything we've done, but we have discussed it, you know, gone back and forth, and we have come to the conclusion that for the beginning, we're going to go with the $500 per doctor and not attempt at this point to vary according to classification.
Okay, what do you think the premiums will be to doctors with coverage up to $500,000, then plus the $500 he has to add into the pot? What do you anticipate the premiums, how will they compare with what the doctors are now paying?
It's very difficult to correlate it because we, at this point, we have no policy in existence that writes $500,000 of insurance. It's $100 million, $2.5 million, and $5 million.
These are just sections that are necessary. We're just about to cut
away. I'm sorry. We don't have a comparative policy in existence, and so it's difficult to tell. For those doctors who write or who are only writing 100, 300, if it's their option they elect to come into this program, they're going to have to increase their 100 to the 500. So they're going to have an increase. And they'd have to pay $500 more. So you're probably looking at, instead of $1,100 or $1,200 in that low group, you might be looking at $1,600 or $1,700 for that group. For the doctors in the $1 million category, $2.5 million category, and the $5 million category, it should result in reductions. We have contracted for an actuarial study with a firm of actuaries. We can't project it until we know what we're dealing with.
Right, sure.
Senator Smith.
Mr. Noble, would you advise your clients, should this bill pass, that now have $5 million in coverage, to cancel the policy, take out $500,000 plus $500,000, because we've said that they have immunity?
You're asking me that question?
Yes. No.
He doesn't represent doctors.
Well, he's such a good leader, isn't he? That's why I'm asking you.
Well, we've been trying to trying to figure out as part of our discussion this afternoon. You asked this question and I never answer. I always respond off the side, but we've been trying to figure out a way that we can get this thing tested in the court so that Mr. Cooney can advise his clients with absolute assurance they don't have to carry any more coverage than what's provided in this bill. Now, whether we can get it tested or not, I don't know. But we'd cooperate in getting it tested so that the doctor would know. If I were asked by a doctor whether he should carry insurance besides this, I'd send it to Mr. Cooney for a call.
What we're this is a real problem for us. We don't know the answer. Here's our thought. We have this commitment from this actuarial group to complete this study within 30 to 60 days once we know what we've got, which will be plenty of time in advance of the expiration date of the CNA policy. Part of that study is the cost of the straight $500,000 policy, plus what it would cost, which means a great decrease in your premiums because of your 5 million, 2.5 million, 1 million people coming down. But that could be secure only if we can get the umbrella policy protecting the group, which is in the nature of the aggregate, at a sufficient saving so that that cost comes all the way down. That will come out of our actuarial study. The alternative to that is a speedy constitutional test. And this is what we have been exploring our weak legal minds as a device to get it taken care of.
What's the magic in $500 figure? Where'd it come from?
Right there, probably. There is no particular magic to it. It was an attempt to find some fee bearing in mind. We may not be able to immediately promise great reduction in the rate that isn't so great that it's going to make it prohibitive to go into this program.
Isn't that the thinker and the good way there? You've got 1,500 GPs, and you've got to raise the F rates, and you've got to bring the anesthesiologists way down here, and they're never going to buy it.
Well, no, you have about 300 of your GPs who carry 100 or less. And then
there's 134.
134, all right, and everybody else carries a million or more. And we have a very small number that carry only 100, 300. And those are the ones that may elect not to come in because it would be more expensive.
But they would have to insure themselves someplace else.
Oh, yes, but the people that are getting killed are the people at the top. And the idea, at least through our self-insurance program, and I'm sure at CNA when they make their proposals in December will have to make the same actuarial projections that we're going to, is, and as counsel for the OMA, I'm going to ask them if they won't write a $500,000 policy and then an umbrella to the group at a substantially reduced crop cost to protect them in the event that this thing goes haywire on constitutionality. In my view, this bill, and this is the reason for the preamble, has a much stronger constitutional basis than the straight limitation, because the giving back to the public in exchange for this immunity is a solvent defendant professional with no less than $500,000 coverage, which is in effect almost a form of mandatory insurance, which is a benefit to the public, which is in exchange for the potential of accepting something less than 100% of the dollar for your judgments and settlements over $500,000. But I cannot say to you immediately it's going to result in this reduction.
Bob, you have comments?
In answer to Senator Brown's question, a number of family practitioners
surgery who were dropping down the class so that they pay a lower premium. With this, it'll permit them to do the assisted surgery and do the surgery and put them back up so that they wouldn't be paying that high premium. So actually it would help us on the manpower side.
But you really ain't the figures acceptable to the medical society.
Okay. Let's get to section 19.
Section 19 requires the commissioner to transmit to the legislative assembly data and information relating to the fund and the payments, so that in effect part of it would be your actuarial study, so that the legislature can be advised of the status of the fund for the purposes of increasing or decreasing the annual fee.
Okay, section 20.
Rulemaking power of this is deals with the rulemaking power of the insurance commissioner.
Okay, 21.
Section 21 deals with the investment or creation of the fund and authorizes the deposit with the treasurer by banks. Says that the money is deposited in the fund are continuously appropriated for the purpose of paying compensation to individuals and paying administrative expenses of the division.
How these monies may be invested, no, that wouldn't include, that doesn't include stock markets, does it?
It's in banks.
No.
Everybody down here says providing a ORS. Somebody, I don't know what those ORS is.
I think that's the prudent man role by that governs the state treasurer.
And in the last section, indicates that the earnings from the investments are go back into the fund phase.
Okay.
It's a state treasury.
22?
Oh, that's in here, yeah.
You have a subsection too there. Is there anything you want to talk about there?
Well, this is the one point we didn't agree on. This allows the commissioner to take the fund and purchase insurance or reinsurance. The doctors are opposed to that provision because they feel they're back in the reinsurance spiral ball game again.
But I'll defend yourself, Lester.
Well, I just feel, Madam Chairman, that it's prudently that we should seek a reinsurance program that can be purchased and protect the fund from excess claimed against it. Somebody might come in with a $7 or $8 million judgment and get it right off the bat. And first you got a $500,000 deductible because of primary coverage. Then you can seek a excess over $1 million, you got $1.5 million, and I just feel that you could probably buy some excess coverage there to protect the entire amount. It would be the proper thing to do. I don't quite understand the doctor's position in this. Certainly, if you took all the premiums and bought excess coverage, and that would be not the proper thing to do. But I certainly feel the commissioner ought to have the option to look into this, and if he can find the coverage that's available and a reasonable premium, he should buy them.
Could we put something in here that if you find it that you could only do so with the approval of the if you're, well, I started to say, but that would mean the OMA and insurance people. But it may be that people that you all stay privately covered and won't have your own fund. You won't have your own company. Well, discussion on it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Coon.
I move that we retain the license, if that's what it is, that gives to the commissioner the authority to purchase excess insurance.
Madam Chairman, I'd like to speak on the question. If this Christmas tree with all the ornaments is going to fly, it's going to fly because the doctors cooperate and buy it.
And I just think that we ought to be somewhat reasonable about their request, because I think we have to get their cooperation. And so I'm hesitant, really, to, at this point at least, maybe down the road we'll see that there is a reinsurance program available through the $500 additional contributions, but at this point I would prefer to land on the doctor's side, hoping that they'll buy this kind of program nice, and they've got a tough selling job.
Are there discussions on the motion?
What's the motion?
Motion is that we adopt, I guess, subsection 2. It's kind of a backwards motion.
Well, I just didn't have someone else move to take it out that I'm trying to accomplish.
Well, the question is whether subsection 2 shall be a part of the bill. If you vote aye, then you are voting to keep subsection 2 in the bill. If you vote no, you're voting to take it out. I guess that's the only way I can put it. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Brown? No.
Now that means to take it out.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye means to leave it in.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Well, if we
vote no, you take it out. If you vote aye, you leave it in.
Aye.
Senator Powell?
He votes aye.
He's gone.
Senator Smith?
No.
Senator Grimstead?
No.
Madam Chairman?
No. So, subsection 2 is out.
I don't know the rule.
This can be put back in after you begin to find out whether or not there's reinsurance and convince the doctors that they're going to be better off if they use their money for that.
Madam Chairman, I will be put back in until 1977.
That's right. But we're not going to have, this fund isn't really going to be there in 1977 either.
Well, Madam Chairman,
you know,
when we originally discussed this yesterday, I distinctly remember hearing that this was one of the provisions that was, I thought, was going to be included in this compromise package that came in, that this was one of the options that would be available to the trustee, was to purchase excess coverage.
Well, maybe the insurance commissioner made that statement, but I don't know that I recall the reactions of the other people on it.
Madam Chairman, if we water this thing down 2 months, they're just not going to be able to buy reinsurance. I don't know whether they'll come in now, but the gentleman that they're going to come in, but if you don't do what they want,
it's
your pleasure to think what might happen.
Madam Chairman, are you ready for a motion?
Jerry, just a minute. What's your motion, Senator Brown? Well, we haven't gone through the other sections yet, but we're just about there. Section 22.
Section 22 limits the liability of the fund for payments to the available funds.
Good, just keep going.
And this section 24, 25, and the deal with matters that Mr. Noble and I have not prepared.
Are there any questions on the rest of the provisions?
Yes, Madam Chairman. What does section 24 mean?
Well,
what the section, and that refers back to section 11. Now, what is all that about? Looking at it earlier.
Well, the question is, Senator, the hospitals feel that there's a possibility that they might get honked on this set up, that they are included. Trying to determine just how you would include them and what price, what their bed and so forth, like we've done in the Florida plant. We came to an impasse with the fee. So this merely states that after a hearing, the insurance commissioner would find that the hospitals were finding themselves in the same position that the doctors find themselves right now, somewhere down between now and 1977, that we could institute a similar program to the hospitals. That was the thing. We didn't know whether to put it together or make it separate, how much per bed. The highest, I think the piece said the highest settlement they made so far is $200,000.
$100,000.
But I can tell the committee right now that if things continue the way they're continuing, by the time you meet 1977, you're going to be faced with a problem, if not sooner than the hospitals. It's already been a hit to other states right now.
Well, but I have some reservations about this being the perfect bill to take care of the problem, even though it seems to be the best thing to think of now. And if you're going to treat hospitals the same way, but this bill turns out to not to be so perfect.
Madam Chair?
So maybe you're not going to want to do that to the hospitals.
This would be after a hearing, and they would have a bigger opportunity to. I would assume that they'd be the ones who would institute the request for the hearing to prompt it.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Seems to me that this is too vague and trying to delegate authority when we don't know the facts or circumstances or even that there's a problem. And unless there are specific amendments to bring the hospital specifically into this program, we know exactly what we're talking about. We shouldn't include them with this vague language. I understand that they are not having a particular problem now. And when the problem arises, if it does, it can be dealt with. I move that we delete section 24.
Well, I'm 23.
I'm 23, but the section
that's
deleted.
Those are the two.
Okay, 23 and 24.
The motion is to delete sections 23 and 24, which relates to hospitals. Further discussion? The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
No.
Senator Powell? Senator Smith?
No.
Senator Dursden?
No.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. What's the count?
4-3.
4-4.
4
ayes.
4 ayes. Madam Chairman, let us ask, Richard.
He deleted
it. And the hospitals paying large insurance policies, which they do, is it more up to bring in reinsurance companies?
I don't, Senator Power, to be perfectly frank, I don't believe that it's having an effect on the reinsurance companies as to the doctors. I don't, the hospitals, I understand, carry $1 million policy. The doctors are talking about $500,000 policy. The problem I think that Pete's concerned with is that quite frequently we don't have a judgment against both the doctor and the hospital, and there's going to be a conflict between the fund and what they.
But you have the authority, Les, to. They write the blanket coverage for hospitals. The excess limits and umbrella they've got them covered.
Okay.
What is it? That they could work with the doctors to help get the umbrella over the doctors.
You could decide all of the amount that they're going to, what their liability limit's going to be, and then how much they have to put into a pool and all that sort of thing. And it seems to me that that's not a lot of authority to give you. You may know more about it than the legislature does, but you know the legislature likes to likes to be involved.
That's why I got to be back next year, Howard. I'm afraid 2 years from now,
we can always. We could always amend this bill, provide that it have emergency board approval, Madam Chair.
Yeah, that's right. And have that committee review the rules he sets up to do it, and all of that. Senator Brown moves that we send House Bill 2647 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Aye.
Senator
Brown.
Aye.
Aye.
Senator Cook.
No.
Senator Howard.
Aye.
Senator Powell.
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator
Brewster?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye.
Madam
Chairman, I'd like to explain my vote. It seems to me that by not making any provision in this bill to ensure that it will be actuarially sound, that you're building in to the bill an explicit basis for finding it unconstitutional. And I think that if the MDs, I think they're suffering under a delusion if they think that by doing this, they're protecting themselves. It would seem to me that if you could set up an actuarially sound excess insurance fund, that one could with some assurance expect is going to do the job, then the argument would be, in sustaining its constitutionality, that you provided a better device for ensuring the payment of judgments than you have now, and that, in a sense, would justify its existence. But here, you're putting in a built-in guarantee that the fund will become insolvent over time. And you got no way to get out of it. You're relying on legislative action. If it doesn't occur, I would think the legislature is not going to deal with it. The court is not going to look at what the legislature might do. The court, in looking at this, I would think, would look at this as an act that's been adopted for eternity and judge its constitutionality on that basis.
Anybody else care to explain your vote?
I voted for it because I worked hard and I see this bill.
I'm sure there'll be lots more rhetoric when this gets to the floor of the Senate. We can all make our press statements then. Meeting's adjourned.